Well, over these past months, we've been working our way through this wonderful book of Romans, this great letter written by the Apostle Paul to the church in Rome. Over 15 chapters so far, we've been looking at all the wonderful themes, all the deep, rich truths that Paul has been communicating to these Roman Christians. And today we come to the very final chapter, Romans 16. And after all of the wonders that we've seen, all the deep truths that we've explored and plumbed the depths of, Romans 16 might seem like a bit of a letdown. Because for the most part, this is simply a list of names and greetings. It's not uncommon for the Apostle Paul to finish his letters in this way. If you look through the New Testament, you'll find that Paul does this again and again. He finishes his letters with a few different greetings, some final words. But here we have a significant list of people to greet. And so we might tackle this chapter and think, either we can leave it behind, or we might puzzle over what is going on here. Before I went into full-time Christian work, I was a secondary school teacher. And one of the things you have to do as a secondary school teacher is take a register of the pupils to tell who are there and, more significantly, which pupils aren't there. And by the kind of little way into term, you can do that quite quickly and without sort of doing that out loud. But at the beginning of term for each class, you don't know the pupils, so you have to call the register out loud. And invariably, as you go through the names, there would be one or two who would have somewhat tricky names that I would struggle to pronounce. And I would trip over their names, and they would have to be very patient with me, as over the course of a number of lessons, we would finally learn, and I would finally learn how to pronounce their names. Well, maybe as you glance down at Romans chapter 16, you feel much the same. Here are a bunch of names, some of whom are okay. I think we can all probably pronounce Mary in verse 6, and we might be good for one or two others, but a lot of them just seem to be very hard to pronounce. And it seems perhaps that all that Paul is doing here is calling the register. I mean, is that all the significance of this chapter? Is it just name-dropping those who need to be mentioned at the end? You know, people, the great and the good in Rome, that he knows he needs to mention just to get a shout-out to them and make sure that they're in there, but he'll just tack them on at the end, call the register, make sure that those who need to be mentioned are done, and that's it. Back in the previous chapter of Romans 15, Paul had talked about the Christian scriptures, and he said that what was written in the past was written to teach us. And so we might read this chapter and scratch our heads and think, what on earth does this chapter have to teach us? Does it have anything to teach us today? Well, let me tell you, I think this chapter has a lot to teach us. It may seem like a register of names, but actually these names and the verses that follow them that Luke read for us tell us a great deal. They teach us a great deal. They tell us a great deal about the kind of people these Roman Christians were. And indeed, more importantly, about the kind of church that God was making them into. So rather than skip over Romans 16 or scratch our heads and think it's irrelevant, let's take a little bit of time today, consider these names and these people, and perhaps see what they have to teach us about what it means to live as Christians today. Because here's the first thing that I want us to see from these list of names in Romans 16, that as we look through this list of people, we find that they are a dedicated people. They're a dedicated people. Just to skim your eyes over those verses 1 to 16 of Romans 16, that long list of names, and you'll notice a number of things, I hope. The first is those tricky to pronounce names, you might puzzle over how you might pronounce one or two of them. But once you get past that, I hope you notice something else very significant, that here are a selection of people who are willing to count the cost of what it means to be a Christian believer. Do you see that? It's there again and again all the way through these verses. Paul starts in verse 1 by highlighting one particular person, someone called Phoebe. Well, we feel a little bit happy with Phoebe. That's a relatively easy name to pronounce, and we might even have a fighting chance of spelling it. But Paul isn't just interested in what Phoebe's name is. He wants to talk about who she is. He tells us a bit about her. She is a deacon, a church official from a church in Crenshaw. Probably. See, I told you I wasn't very good at pronouncing things. Krenkere, which is a few miles outside of Corinth. Now, Paul was likely in Corinth when he was writing this letter. And more likely is that Phoebe was the one who delivered the letter to the Romans. So as Paul was in Corinth writing this letter to encourage this Roman church, so Phoebe was sent from Corinth to Rome with the letter to give to that church. And perhaps as Paul was writing this, he added this at the end without Phoebe knowing, so that when this letter is read out, because that's likely what would have happened, that as the letter was received by the church, it would have been read out publicly, so Phoebe would hear Paul's words about her. And Paul says that he commends her. Verse 1, I commend to you our sister Phoebe. He commends her. But it's not her postal skills that he is commending. He's not just saying, well, thankfully, this letter has got here. I put a first-class stamp on it, and it made it there, and it made it there safely. No, I think Paul is commending more than that. He is commending the fact that she has been a benefactor. Do you see that in verse 2? I ask you to receive her in the Lord in a way worthy of his people and give her any help she may need from you, for she has been the benefactor of many people, including me. And Paul uses a very specific word there. It's a word that really conveys the idea of patron. Here is Phoebe, who was clearly a wealthy woman, but she was willing to put her money to work in supporting the work of the church. She spent her money in supporting people like Paul so that the message of Jesus might go out to those who have not yet heard it. And so says Paul, I commend to you Phoebe. I commend her to you, not just because she calls herself a Christian. It's very easy for people to call themselves a Christian, but you can see that she is living it out. Her Christian faith is at work in the way that she lives and the way that she acts. That here is someone who is worth commending because she is dedicated to Jesus. And you see that dedication in the way that it affects her bank balance. You see, dedication to Jesus is working its way out in Phoebe's life. And it's very often our bank balances where we see the things that we think of as most important. It's where we are willing to spend our money. Well, if you read those words about Phoebe and think, well, that's just a little bit extreme. I mean, surely you wouldn't want to spend all your money on supporting these strange mission partners like Paul. Just take a look at what comes next. Our next two people that Paul commends and greets are in verse 3 and 4. And they are a pair, a married couple, Priscilla and Aquila, who Paul calls fellow workers in Christ Jesus. And they are dedicated too because they are willing to risk their lives for Paul. If you thought Phoebe's dedication was a bit extreme, here are people who are willing to give their very lives. In fact, the words that Paul uses literally means that they were willing to stick their necks out for me, which is a phrase we use today about risking who we are and what we've got. But for Priscilla and Aquila, it would have been a very literal risk of sticking their necks out and having their heads chopped off. They risked their lives. They risked execution for being willing to stand up and say, I belong to Christ Jesus, and I'm willing to stand alongside this man, Paul, in proclaiming the truth about Jesus. They stuck their necks out. They risked their very lives. That is extreme dedication, isn't it? And you might begin to think, well, that's terrific, isn't it? Here are two people who are so close friends of Paul that they're willing to risk their lives. I don't know if there's anyone that you know who you'd be willing to risk your life for. Maybe if you're a parent, you might think, well, I'd be willing to risk my life for my child. But there isn't much that we would risk our lives for. But what's surprising is that Paul says this isn't just our friendship that is causing these two people to risk their lives. It is wider than that. Verse 4, they risked their lives for me. Not only I, but all the churches of the Gentiles are grateful for them. You see, it's not their friendship for Paul that causes them to be willing to do this. It's their dedication to the Christian faith. It was on behalf of the church that they acted in this way. They are dedicated to Jesus. And I wonder, do you notice that we see that again and again throughout this chapter, of people willing to dedicate their all for the Christian faith? We see it in verse 7 with Andronicus and Junia, again, probably a husband and wife team, who were willing to be imprisoned with Paul for the Christian faith. They were willing to stand up and be counted to count the cost and even be put in chains for being called a Christian. Apelles, verse 10, we're told, has stood the test in his faithfulness to Jesus. We're not told what that test is, but the way it's phrased is likely that this is some kind of persecution. He has been tested. It's been painful and costly for him, but he has stayed faithful and been dedicated to Jesus. And woman after woman throughout this list, we're told, work very hard in the Lord. Here are people who are willing not only to say that they're Christians, but to live as Christians, to give their all for the Christian faith and risk losing all for the Christian faith. See, far from a list of just names, this is a wonderful picture of dedication that is costly and painful. It is no superficial faith. It's no fading commitment. It is devotion of the highest order. And I wonder if we read this kind of devotion, the sort of willingness to be imprisoned or risk your lives for the Christian faith, and that begins to make us feel somewhat uncomfortable. Because I suspect normally we don't like to go to those extremes. Yeah, we might think, well, it's nice to have a hobby and go to church on a Sunday and believe in Jesus, but it's important not to get too carried away with these things. That's certainly a British way to approach things. Maybe you come from a different culture and different background, but certainly British people tend to be somewhat reserved and think, well, everything in moderation. You know, don't get too carried away with things. Don't take things to extremes. It's nice to do this or that, but nothing is worth that kind of dedication. Isn't this all just taking things a bit too far? But you see, what Paul wants us to understand as he lists this list of greetings is that this is not taking things too far. This is what Christianity means. This is what real Christianity should look like. It's a willingness, a dedication to give your all and hold nothing back. See, Paul wants us to see that Christianity simply cannot be relegated to a pastime. It's not a hobby. It's not just a nice thing to do on a Sunday morning if the weather's nice and it's not raining too hard and we can make it to church and the tubes are running and if I can get there, then that's okay. It is something so important, so vital, so amazing that it is worth dedicating your whole self, your whole life to. It's worth even giving up your life for that wonderful truth. You see, Paul reminds us of that at the end of this chapter. If you look ahead to verses 25 to 27, you'll see that he prays a prayer at the very end of this whole letter. And it's a prayer that sums up lots of the themes of the letter that we've seen all the way through these 16 chapters. Let me read it again to you from verse 25. Now to him who is able to establish you in accordance with my gospel, the message I proclaim about Jesus Christ in keeping with the revelation of the mystery hidden for long ages past, but now revealed and made known through the prophetic writings by the command of the eternal God, so that all the Gentiles might come to the obedience that comes from faith, to the only wise God, be glory forever through Jesus Christ. Amen. It's a rich prayer. It's full of lots of different theological truths. There's so much packed in there. And it links back to so much that Paul has already been talking about in the whole of the letter to the Romans. But I wonder, do you notice in that prayer what it is that drives the dedication of these Roman Christians? It is that there is only one wise and eternal Creator God. He is the one who deserves all glory forever and ever. And yet, as we say that and think about that, we realize, and as Paul has been unpacking throughout the whole of the letter, that we don't give him the glory that he deserves. But rather, we've ignored him and resisted him. We've disobeyed and rebelled against that wise Creator. But one day, we will stand before him. One day, we will have to give an account. And the big question that's driven the whole of what Paul is saying in Romans is, how on earth can we do that? How on earth can we stand before a wise, eternal, holy God and be safe? And the answer, Paul tells us, is because of the gospel, the good news about Jesus. You see, Paul says, verse 25, now to him who is able to establish you, literally to make you stand. God is able to make us stand before him, forgiven, made clean, in right relationship with our Creator God. And the reason for that is because the good news about Jesus Christ, the gospel, good news. This is good news that Jesus has dealt with the problem of our rebellion. Again, Paul has been talking about throughout this letter to the Romans. He's dealt with our problem of sin, of turning our back on God, and he's provided a way for us to stand again in right relationship before our Creator God. That is the gospel, the good news about Jesus. And you see that if we've really understood this, this truth that stands at the heart of the Christian faith, then the Christian faith can never, ever be a hobby. Because it is the story that is at the center of our whole universe. It is the mystery hidden but now revealed, which is spoken across human history, of God's rescue plan for the human race. This is no pastime, an add-on to our lives. It is literally life or death. And so it is worth dedicating the whole of our lives to. Now, you may be here today looking into these things. You're perhaps thinking through the Christian faith, but you're not yet convinced about things. And you may be surprised, perhaps even offended, by the idea that there is a God who made you and a God who you have to give an account to. But likely you are here because of a Christian friend. Someone who's been talking to you about Christian things, who has been talking through these ideas about who Jesus is, trying to persuade you. They may have even told you that they've done the most radical thing that they could possibly think of, and that is to pray for you. And perhaps you've come along today and you've come to church just to get them to shut up. You think, well, they keep banging on about Jesus. They seem to be so obsessed with Jesus. If I just go to church once, then maybe they could shut up about it. But do you see why they keep going on about it? Do you see why they are so obsessed and dedicated to this truth? Because it is the same reason that these Roman Christians were dedicated, even to the point of risking their lives and sticking their necks out. It is because if this is true, this is the most important thing in the universe, and it is worth risking everything for, even friendships and relationships. So what's amazing is that even the most vocal atheists understand this. One vocal atheist is the magician Penn Jillette. He's one of the half of the duo Penn and Teller. He's a very vocal atheist, but he said, look, I completely understand and respect Christians who are willing to try and share their faith with me. I don't believe it, but I understand where they're coming from. And this is how he explains it. He says this: if I believed beyond the shadow of a doubt that a truck was coming at you, and you did not believe that a truck was bearing down on you, there is a certain point where I tackle you. And this, the Christian faith, is more important than that. Jesus, I understand why Christians are so obsessed, willing to dedicate everything, willing to risk everything for the Christian faith, because they understand that this is the most important thing ever. See, Christianity can never be a hobby or a pastime or an add-on to an already busy life. It must be something that is at the center of who we are and that we are willing to dedicate our whole lives to, because it is that important. Well, that's a key truth that we see as we read through these verses, we read through these lists of names, that this is a dedicated people. But I want to see a couple of other quick things before we finish with this list of names. And I want us to see that not only is this a dedicated people, but it is also, as we look through these names, a diverse people. Again, just skim your eyes over these list of names again. And as you go through, you probably kind of think, well, some of them are very curious. If you're thinking of a sort of a list of baby names to pick, you may not sort of instantly pick all of them. You might go for Mary or Phoebe. They'd be fairly safe bets, but you probably wouldn't go for Herodian as top list of baby names in 2016. So likely these names don't mean a huge amount to us. But historians have pored over these names because actually they tell us a great deal. And we know, don't we, that names are significant. Perhaps you know what your name means. And your parents, potentially, as they picked your name, probably didn't pick it out of thin air. They had reasons for picking it. Well, in the first century, names carried an even greater weight than they do today. They signified something about your background and your culture and your class. And as such, we can learn a lot from these names. And what we learn, more than anything else, is the amount of diversity in this church. First of all, there's diversity in gender. Paul lists both men and women in this list, which may not seem surprising to us, but probably is quite surprising in the context of the first century. Men were often the ones in power, so for Paul to mention a number of women in this list is very significant. But even more significant is that most of these women are commended for their work and commitment to the faith. You see that it begins with Phoebe in verse 1. It continues with Priscilla, Mary, Junia, Tryphena, and Tryphosa, Persis, and Rufus' mother. Each one of them are commended as women who have served Christ and his church and who have worked very hard in the Lord. Now, I would say that there's some disagreement over precisely what Paul is referring to, what work he's referring to in these verses, what role these women had in the structures of the early church. And we don't have time to deal with all of those. But what is clear is that both women and men were active in service and had significant ministries in the early church. Both men and women, both genders were involved in the dedication of serving God's people. It wasn't men on the field and women on the sidelines. Both genders are serving the Lord in the work of the church from day one. And given that the reputation that the Apostle Paul often gets of being misogynist because of the teachings in the rest of the New Testament, it is very helpful for us to remember this truth from Romans 16. So we've got a diversity of gender, but not just gender, we've got a diversity of ethnicity as well. You can see that this is a church made up of both Jews and Gentiles, non-Jews. That there is a mix of those who come from a Jewish background as well as those who are completely new to all of that. And that's a subject that Paul has been tackling all the way through this letter. And it's fair to say that that is a subject, an area that hasn't been easy to manage in the churches of the first century. It would have made life quite complicated as Jewish converts to Christianity bring with them a whole host of customs and ways of thinking about things that clash with their non-Jewish Christian counterparts. And so life in the church gets quite interesting. So you've got a diversity of gender and ethnicity, but perhaps most striking here is a diversity of status. You see, as we read through these names, we find that a number of the names are really quite posh. Yeah, the kind of names that you might find on the registers at Eton rather than anywhere else. They are the great and good of Roman society. This is a church with members from the 1%. But you see, at the same time as there are these rich and wealthy and powerful people, this is the same church that has people who used to be slaves but have now been set free. As we read through, we find that there are a number of names that reflect Greek or Roman gods, and they are most likely people who have once been slaves but who have now been granted their freedom. So here we have a church where the rich and powerful are there, and those who once were slaves but now have been set free. But even more amazingly, in this church there are also those who are currently slaves. Do you see verse 10 and 11? Talk about those in the household of Aristobulus and a Narcissus. And that is really a way of saying those who are slaves in those places. Now, there's a lot that could be said about attitudes to slavery and the way that Christians responded to the slave trade, but we don't have time to do that now. But imagine this, that the good news about Jesus, about his death and resurrection, comes to Rome. The gospel is proclaimed. And a wealthy senator hears the good news about Jesus, and he responds to it and believes. And then a small businessman, a former slave who has now set up business for themselves, they hear the same gospel and they believe the same gospel and respond to it. And then the same message goes out into the household of a well-known person in Roman society, and even the slaves in that household hear it. And maybe the slave owner doesn't respond, but the slaves respond. They hear and they believe. So you've got the wealthy senator, you've got the small business owner who used to be a slave, you've got the current slaves, and they all come together and become part of the same church. See, that's extraordinary, isn't it? It's extraordinary that people who would never, ever interact in the same way, who would never come together, now are brought together across the different aspects of society, across social status, into the church. And Paul wants us to see this is a direct result of the Christian gospel. Look with me again at verse 26. Again, in this prayer that Paul ends this wonderful letter with. And he says this, that the good news of Jesus is given so that all the Gentiles might come to the obedience that comes from faith. So what he wants us to see is that the gospel, the good news about Jesus, is available to everyone. It's available both to Jews, but also to Gentiles, non-Jews. There's no ethnic barrier that separates people from responding to the good news about Jesus. It is available to all. And the reason it's available to all is because it comes through faith. The same way for every single person to enter into God's kingdom, to find the wonderful forgiveness that Jesus offers, is through faith, by believing in what God has done. So it's not wealth or power that will do it. It's not intellect or learning. It's not skill or experience. It is faith. Taking God at his word and trusting him. And you see, that levels the playing field. It's the same way into God's kingdom for the 99% as the 1%. It's the same for the elite as for the downtrodden. It's the same for each and every person. And so that becomes visible in our churches. Just look around us now. As we gather together on a Sunday, we gather from something like 65 different nationalities. And that is a group of people, just like this group in the Roman church, that probably would never naturally gather together in the same way. After all, by ourselves, we tend to gravitate towards the people who are like us. The people who think like us, the people who have the same background and culture as us. But here in this place, we have such a diverse church family because we all come in the same way, through trusting in God. And that means, of course, that church is never ever going to be a comfortable place where everyone is like us. Rather, it's because of our diversity, it will generate a lot of problems and issues and difficulties and misunderstandings and all of the complexity of life together. But you know what? That diversity is not a problem, but a privilege. It shows we are brought together, we are held together by the gospel of Jesus Christ. That gospel is available to all, and so we are shown to be people from all different places and all different statuses. Our diversity and all of the complexities it brings are a God-given gift to show the gospel at work. So we have a dedicated people, we have a diverse people. Let's add one final piece as we finish, because the final thing that we see from this list is that we have also a dependent people. Again, as we look at this list of names, we might scratch our heads and think, well, why on earth does Paul write this list in the first place? I mean, why does he add Romans 16? He could have ended at Romans 15. It ends nicely. It even has the word amen at the end of the chapter. I mean, that's a nice sort of finishing point. Why add all these lists of greetings at all? And the answer is because Paul needs these people. They are people who have served him in the past. They've worked together and suffered together in prison and elsewhere. And now he needs them to support his ongoing work of spreading the gospel where it is not yet known. And that is surprising that Paul needs these people. Because as we think about and read about the Apostle Paul, he seems to be one of the most capable Christians you could possibly imagine. You read about his exploits in the book of Acts, and he seems to have boundless energy and ambition and enthusiasm. He is gifted and knowledgeable and able. He wrote a large portion of the New Testament, and he planted churches all the way from Jerusalem up to what is now modern-day Albania. He seems to be the perfect Christian to have everything he needs and not to need another soul. And yet, Paul says, I need you. I need you. See, Paul is no Lone Ranger Christian. This list of greetings shows that he needed others in the Christian life. In fact, he even needed someone to write this very letter down for him. We find that in verse 22, that Tertius wrote the letter down for Paul. And indeed, as he writes these greetings, he is connecting the Roman Christians with one another. And he is communicating to them that they need each other too. That's an important thing for us to hear. Because I think we can easily slip into thinking about life as a solo Christian. Yeah, maybe to think, well, you know what? I've grown so much in the Christian faith that I don't really need to go to church that often. And I can drop in when I like, but it's not a problem if I don't. And if I do go along to church, well, I don't really need to get involved with others. I don't need to join one of those small groups which just takes up so much time of the week and get stuck in with all the mess and complexities of others' life. Surely life is so much more simple when it's just me and God. It's a kind of John Wayne style of Christian, that rugged individual, dependent on no one. Heading off into the wild unknown, just me and God, and it links in nicely with our culture's ideal of the individual who is self-sufficient, who needs nobody else. But the problem with that picture is it is completely at odds with the Bible's picture of what it means to be a Christian. See, the Bible tells us we need one another. We are to be involved with one another. We see that in the life of Paul. And let me tell you, if the Apostle Paul, with all his energy and all his ability and all his gifts, needed others, then we certainly need others as well. And Paul here encourages that in these verses. He says to them, greet one another. Extend your hand. Shake one another's hands. Be involved in one another's lives. Get stuck in. As Christians, we are to be dependent people. We are to need one another. And we are to be a dependent people because ultimately we are dependent on God. So this is the truth that is worth holding in our mind, that we cannot go it alone in the Christian faith because we cannot be self-sufficient when it comes to God. We cannot save ourselves. We need God to act for us. And our interdependence in church life is a sign that we are dependent on God. And our desire, perhaps, to be a solo Christian is maybe a sign that we are refusing to trust God and we are trying to save ourselves. And what we need to do is come back to the truths of Paul's prayer at the end of this letter. You see, we can stand wonderfully before our wise and eternal God, but it is not because of our doing. It is because of the work of Jesus Christ. The good news that has been spoken to us and in which we trust. And we can stand before our Almighty God, not because we are able to stand, but because He is able to make us stand. And that is what brings us together. It's what brings us together as a wonderfully diverse church. It's what makes us dedicated to this truth. And it's what keeps us dependent, first of all, on God. And then on one another. And that is the most amazing and wonderful truth to stand on. Well, let me pray. And let me pray this wonderful prayer for us as we close. So now to Him who is able to establish each one of us in accordance with the gospel, that message which has been proclaimed to us about Jesus Christ, in keeping with the revelation of the mystery hidden for long ages past, but now revealed and made known through the prophetic writings by the command of the eternal God, so that all people might come to the obedience that comes from faith. To the only wise God be glory forever through Jesus Christ. Amen.